How good are numbers? They can blow minds, they can help us see the invisible, and they can even help us count. But in the wrong hands, they can also numb. On Thursday, April 20, Sweathead is hosting our first ever online conference about numbers, number-adjacent things, and number-identifying people. It's called WTF, the Effing Effectiveness Festival. Over 3 hours, 9 number experts will try to blow your mind one at a time. Do you have a mind? Well, prepare to get it blown by Associate Marketing Professor Colin Campbell in his plea to get you to do A-B testing. Google's Esty Gorman and her demand that we F the funnel. Sage's James Hankins in his sharing about the importance of share of search. Ogilvy's Ella Jenkins poking at our subconscious and how it's our boss. Magic Numbers' Dr. Grace Kite's warning about the dangers of digital attribution. DCDX's Andrew Roth's gravity-defying tale about the black hole consuming Gen Z. Walk Headbrain David Tiltman's work about how often creative award winnings are also effing effective. Author and System One's Orlando Wood's sour take about how the advertising brain has turned to lemons. And Jellyfish's Tom Roach will drop some squishy effectiveness pearls of wisdom all over the place. WTF, the effing effectiveness festival. It's marketing that will blow your mind from Sweathead, the strategy people inside your head. Online, Thursday, April 20, 2023, from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. ET. That's New York time, baby. Find out more at sweathead.com. Group discounts are available. What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have Elizabeth Bromberg, who's recently set up a brand consultancy called Mildred May. Elizabeth spent over 12 years in and around advertising and brands. Today, we're going to talk about empathy and also a little thing that Elizabeth's putting together called How to Speak Strategist. Elizabeth, big, clumsy, awkward question straight off the bat. You've just set up your own consultancy. How are your feels right now?
Oh, man, it's rough. I'll probably have a different answer for you every day, every week. You know, there were kind of two reasons I decided to set up my own brand consultancy. The first was I had never freelanced before, and I really wanted to try it and see what it was like to really kind of do my own thing and being able to take my own values and beliefs and be able to kind of just like run with that versus having to follow kind of corporate culture a little bit. But the second more realistic impetus was, and why I'm really focusing on it right now, is I lost my full-time job. I was laid off in October, this past October, from the agency I was working at, which was Weber Shandwick. And, you know, I'm sure anyone listening to this in the industry is very aware of how the economy has impacted our industry and client budgets and how that's gone down to agencies and big networks and small agencies. And I was impacted by that. And consulting is a way for me to hopefully make ends meet outside of working for an agency full time. So it's definitely rough. It's hard starting out because you have to kind of try and build a client base from scratch, which is challenging when you're brand new, when you have no brand recognition. And, you know, when you've spent your entire career having signed NDAs saying that you're not going to compete and, you know, work for certain brands for the next year or so. And that kind of also really kind of impacts what you are able to do immediately. But it's fun. I like that I'm able to kind of delve into my curiosity and work with different types of clients and kind of figure out who I am also as like more of an independent strategist.
There you go. There you go. A lot of us who do this kind of work, we start to self-actualize aggressively through our own little businesses. I started therapy again recently and the psychologist, the therapist commented on that. And I was like, well, my business is a compartment of my life that I have more control over and I can be more of myself in that compartment in many ways. And so I hope you get to experience that. I'm 7 years in, actually, basically right around now.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah, thank you. And the reason that I'm saying it is because the first 3 years, it can feel turbulent. You know, you got to get used to December and January, and maybe even into February could be very quiet. Yeah, you're going to hear stories about people, you know, they're crushing it and all these jobs are coming in. But there are seasons here. There are seasons when you start up and the seasons are often spring and fall. And you've got to work out how to build your life around what you want to do with a different rhythm because you need to be the hare and the tortoise. Yet many of us who've only known agency lives were hares, which is running around, filling in the timesheet, getting stuff done, running the workshop, writing an agenda, writing the deck, da-da-da. But when you're running your own company, you've got to be like that for your clients, but also Maybe you need to go for a half day walk and contemplate what you're even doing, right? It takes time, 3 to 5 year journey, I think at least. How are you adjusting to that hare and tortoise paradox or energy?
It's definitely challenging because I think one of the things that's really hard about being a strategist for me is that I love what I do. And I love what I do because what I get to do as a strategist is basically a reflection of the things that I'm passionate about and my own characteristics, strengths, weaknesses, whatever you want to call it. Doing it on my own where I'm not accountable for, you know, a larger company who's like setting the rules and I have that structure means that I am basically have less work-life balance and I'm more bound to have less work-life balance on my own because I'm just constantly trying to both build my business, but I'm still so driven by like the things that innately you want to do as a strategist that you don't spend as much time as you want doing because you're like bounded by the structure of like an agency or a client deadline that's given to you by someone else. And that was probably a really confusing way of what I just said. But essentially, as strategists, we in agencies, we never have enough time to really dive into the problem that we're trying to solve. We don't have enough time like to spend in the research that we want to most of the time. There's much quicker turnarounds. We have to kind of figure out, you know, shortcuts, et cetera, like where to kind of like sacrifice parts of our schedule in order to get the work done. The challenge for me as someone who is now running their own business is I no longer feel bound by those structures in the same way because I don't have as many clients and I have more free time as I'm trying to build my business. But that means that I'm winding up spending too long often doing that part of the strategy that I love and digging versus having the structure to be like, okay, I have enough now. I have to go to step two.
Yeah, you need to work out how to give yourself a structure. So you mentioned that now you get to apply your own values and beliefs to what you're doing, and you will have mini epiphanies. Every project you work on, you know this, is going to be a teacher. And you'll be like, I think I believe this. And then you'll have a good experience. You're like, I really believe it. Or an experience that wasn't great. You're like, I'm not doing that again that way. What are three beliefs that you are really going to bring into the work you're going to be doing from now on?
The first is empathy above everything. And empathy is such a loaded word. It's such a buzzword, especially so as strategists. One of the ways people like to explain an insight, for example, is it's a human truth. Like we use the word human and identifying with audiences as like a core part of who we are and what we do. And so it's a very loaded word, and I can get into that a little bit more. But number one is empathy above everything. Number two is transparency. I think one of the hardest things about working at a big agency, you know, especially an agency that's part of a big network, is as you continue to grow and as you become more of a leader, you're ultimately going to have to participate in politics in one way or another. You have to, and you have to be able to learn how to do that. And I hate that because I hate bullshit. And so a big part of what I want to do is to have a lot more candor in like what I do and what I believe and be able to work with clients who want to actually do what they say they want to do and help them do that. And I think the third is, I don't know if this is a value, having a sense of humor, not taking everything too seriously, being able to infuse a bit of lightheartedness into whatever I'm doing. You know, I think part of that comes from like how I personally like to use like social media, for example, like Instagram. My entire Instagram story is basically just me resharing memes that make me laugh. And a lot of times, actually, those memes might be poking fun at like something that is a very serious topic. And I think that being able to find joy and look for moments of joy, even in the most serious and difficult of subjects, and being able to have that bit of lightheartedness is important just for sanity's sake and my own, you know, survival and people's survival. So I guess those are kind of the three things that I try to focus on the most.
So it's going to be interesting to watch how you evolve this, because empathy, transparency, humor, obviously one could flex as, I guess, the lead actor of your movie. When I look at the website, which you've put up recently, it's very well organized. There's a pigeon, head slanted, a little bit of humor, but it's not as humorous as maybe you could be. So for example, maybe you explore the more serious, earnest side of empathy for a year or two, and then you're like, hang on, I'm sharing all these memes over here. You know what? I'm going to rebrand myself and it's all going to be about strategy that's going to make people laugh. Like, that's kind of the fun part of the entrepreneurial / consultant's journey. You get to become more self-aware and then work out over time which parts of those beliefs you want to play up more and turn off perhaps. So it's going to be fun to watch it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about empathy. I know that a lot of strategists talk about it, because one of the main jobs of the account planner is to try to understand people. The challenge with empathy is that it can also come across a little bit arrogant. Like, to what degree can we truly understand other people? Let's start by defining the word. Do you have a point of view on the definition of the word empathy?
There's three types of empathy, right? If we want to kind of intellectualize it a little bit. And Archana actually spoke about this when you spoke to her. She started to kind of go into it. But like, the first part of empathy is cognitive empathy. So that's like really the ability to understand someone else's perspective. And that's actually more about thinking about someone else's feelings rather than actually fully feeling them. It's more of, I guess, that emotional intelligence aspect of empathy. Emotional empathy is really about actually feeling physically what someone else feels. And that is a part of empathy that maybe not everybody experiences. And that doesn't mean that you're not empathetic or you don't practice or have empathy. It just means like maybe that's, you know, not the area of empathy that like you're the strongest in or that you practice. And then the third is empathic concern. So that's more about intuition and an ability to kind of sense what someone else needs from you, rather. It's about being externally focused and like focused on the other person. I think, you know, in terms of the types of empathy that I think are the most key for a strategist, it's 1 in 3. It's really that cognitive empathy, that ability to, even if you can't put yourself in the shoes of someone and completely understand how their emotions make, like actually feel what their emotions feel like for them, because we can't do that, right? Like, I'm never going to be able to fully understand what someone who has a different experience from me is actually feeling based on that experience. I'm never going to be able to do that. But if I practice cognitive empathy and I work to understand their situation, work to think about what might it be like what are the things that this person like might be feeling, might be experiencing. If I was struggling with something like this, what might my perspective be like? Why do they feel this way? It's the understanding the why. And I think that is really the part of empathy that is the most important, not just for a strategist, but for humans in general. I honestly believe that if everyone in the world practiced, you know, was 5% more empathetic, then we would solve a ton of the world's problems. And I think on the other side of that, for me, kind of figuring out how to define empathy for me and why it was such a strong value is kind of flipping it. And when I think about the things in the world that make me the angriest, that like really set me off and are the things that like I want to fight against, it always comes down to hypocrisy. And I think hypocrisy is like an antithesis of empathy, because hypocrisy is always selfishly motivated. It's always about serving yourself versus putting yourself in another person's shoes and trying to understand somebody else's perspective. It's based solely on yourself.
Yeah, but don't you think we're all wired that way? That's how we as individuals survive, right?
I completely agree with that. No one in the world is not a hypocrite. No one in the world is purely empathetic. I think in human nature, where we have gotten to in everything going on in the world, in the things that cause us our greatest struggles as people, but also in our own individual challenges, I think so much comes down to people not giving enough of a shit about other people's perspectives and taking the time to try and...
Yeah. The challenge with that point of view right now is that, because obviously at some point this connects to politics, which isn't something I tend to spend a lot of time talking about, but basically everyone's being taught to agree with what you just said. So that if you don't agree with me, you're not being empathetic. And it's a tool that's being used by all parts of the media and all parts of politics, because they're just trying to wash away what a lot of these words mean. It's kind of crazy. I want to ask you a dark question, but I'll start with a light point of view. You know, they say that things like travel, learning a language, moving cities, moving between different kind of friend groups can lead to more empathy. Even reading novels But also, empathy for some people is a coping mechanism from when they were young. Surprise, surprise. Why do you think empathy is such an important value to you? And I don't mean intellectually. Like, what happens in your life for you to be like, you know what? I think empathy really, really matters.
We can definitely go there. You know, I struggled with my mental health, especially like starting as like a preteen and teenager. I struggled with depression and major anxiety, and I also had an eating disorder for 20 years. I'm in recovery from a 20-year long eating disorder. And a lot of that stemmed from what I think is like a desire to be valued and a desire to succeed and be seen in a certain way by people around me, you know, be successful in the way that the world defines success.
And where do you think those desires, that cluster of desires came from?
I did grow up with a lot of privilege, especially as a young child. And education was something that was really important to my family. And competition was something that was very important to my family. I have three brothers. I'm the only girl. All my brothers are brilliant. And I saw from a very young age how my mother responded to my brother's academic performance or performance otherwise. And both my parents responded to people in the world who presented themselves in a certain way. And I basically observed that and created a sort of internal rule book for myself of what I needed to do in order to earn my parents' love.
So that's all about status seeking and achievement seeking.
Exactly.
But then how does that lead to empathy? Because you could argue those things, being primed for those things, is the opposite. Like, or that empathy would actually be kryptonite to those things.
100%. It absolutely was. I think where the change really came from is this breakthrough of realizing like that idea that I needed to be a certain way or look a certain way or achieve a certain thing or have a certain job title or make a certain amount of money in order to be valued by the people around me was a core lie that had driven my entire life, had driven a lot of my career. And I realized that what I actually wanted and what I actually was craving the whole time that I thought I was just craving acceptance was belonging. And I think there's a huge difference between accepting someone or feeling accepted and feeling a sense of belonging. And that shift of focusing on belonging and that core kind of human desire that fuels so much of our motivations as people, like also as consumers, is really kind of where that shift towards empathy came. Because for me, it's not about, as I said, being able to feel exactly what the other person is feeling. It's about understanding or trying to have the perspective of where does this person belong in the world? Where do they get their sense of belonging to? And how does that inform how they see the world, how they interact with it, and how their own values and behaviors have been shaped?
Smart person. Hey, pull your mind out of those timesheets for a second and take a look at the Sweathead website. We have three membership levels: Starter Mode, Flight Mode, and Beast Mode. They give you access to a variety of strategy masterclasses, conferences, accelerators, and online learning, some of which has been known to make people cry because they like it, they like it, they feel seen. Make the most of your mind this year or any year and visit www.sweathead.com today. Now back to the interview. So if I was to paraphrase your journey, and definitely correct me if I'm being a little aggressive with the way I'm going to simplify what I think I just heard: high achievement, high status seeking environment to feel loved led to some self-hurt and some self-punishment, which possibly led to the epiphany that you needed to be empathetic for yourself. And through that journey, also realizing that many people could benefit from empathy. Is that too simplistic a story arc?
I don't think so. I think it's fair. I think it was the realization of that distinction between acceptance and belonging, wanting to be accepted and desire to be accepted, and thinking about other people and their perceptions of me and me trying to fit in with what other people's expectations of me were. I was so concerned with what everybody else thought of me for so long and keeping up appearances that I now have basically destroyed my own health.
Your body and your mind have paid a price for you
trying to work out how to please other people when the way to please them, what you understood, was that you had to be exceptional.
Exactly. And a lot of that, especially in terms of my eating disorder, was influenced by the fact that I have been in all types of sizes throughout my life and adulthood. I have been in a significantly larger body. I have been in a significantly smaller body, you know, an eating disorder throughout a lot of it. And I saw very clearly how the world treated me when I didn't fit into a certain mold, and pun is not intended there. I remember what it felt like going into a store and being asked by the sales associate if I was looking for a gift for someone because I very clearly couldn't possibly fit into any size or anything that they sold, or being ignored. To later, when I was in a much smaller body after starving myself and, you know, engaging in all of these behaviors to get me into an acceptable body size, to being just delighted over when I would walk into stores, being helped with being, oh, I think this looked, you know, beautiful on you, you know, seeing the opposite types of treatment that I received based on just something as superficial as like what I looked like, you know, how large or small my body was, and how my experience in the world was so drastically different based on that. Like, it pissed me off. And I think that anger was part of why I was able to finally have more of a successful recovery than I'd had before, because for the first time, I was like, it's not supposed, like, this is fucked up. This is not supposed to be this way. Like, this isn't fair. Like, it is not fair that I'm walking through the world and I'm treated so much better now because I've been starving myself. And now I have all of these health concerns that I didn't have when I was in a larger body, and I'm going to have now for the rest of my life because I've destroyed my body, and that's on me. It shouldn't be like this. It's wrong. It's not just. And I think I needed to get angry and have that experience of getting angry and see that what I was doing and where I was putting my values, it was selfish, it was superficial, and it kept me inside myself all of the time, and was what was preventing me from ultimately getting that sense of belonging.
Some of these things feel like kind of like adjacent to things like OCD, like ADHD, and even autism are kind of connected. They're all ways of dealing with the world in a way where you almost avoid it because you're so into yourself. And that can take some time to break or to correct or to come back from. I want to drag us back into talking about strategy in a second. But why I like to almost indulge in this kind of conversation is because I personally believe that understanding yourself in these ways and allowing yourself to fail and to be reborn and to work out what your real beliefs and values are, even if it's just now and it could change in 10 years' time, I think it helps to make people more savage strategists rather than playing these games of pretend or of keeping most of myself outside of the room or the Zoom because I'm trying to please some corporate overlord. I think this work is, and this kind of discussion is, the way through. It's a little bit Jungian and Nietzschean and all those kinds of people. One last question before we go on to the How Strategists Speak project that you're working on is, with Mildred May, with your consultancy, in the headline, you talk about it being an empathy-driven brand. Now, I would have assumed that anyone doing strategy, anyone talking about brand strategy, would be empathetic, that a lot of their time would be spent exploring people, their minds, and their behavior, to the point where I would assume that it's empathetic work and I wouldn't need to call it out. You've called it out. Why?
I've called it out because I think there's a big difference between assumptions and reality. And calling it out gives me accountability in terms of how I want to do my work and work with people. But it also helps ensure that my clients are held accountable in one way or another. And by that, I mean by putting it out there that everything I do is tied to like actual human behavior and emotion and feelings and values and understanding the perspectives of others, it means that I'm always going to be putting the audience first, not necessarily the clients. And the clients have to be okay with that. It goes back to what I was saying about hypocrisy. I think one of the challenges that we see, you know, working with clients who say that they want to do one thing or they believe in one thing, and then they turn around and do completely the opposite. and they're trying to stand for something with their audience, but behind the curtain, it's all a lie. And by putting empathy out there, I guess I have some very small sense of hope that I will be working with clients who do want to like be radically for what their audience is for and not anything else.
So for you, empathy, there's a sense of radicalism in it. And just a little bit of a meta note, I hope you don't mind me making this commentary as you go. I just love watching people launch their own things and then working out who they are and watching their journeys. You know, do they stay independent? Do they actually take a job? Do they grow a team? Do they then sell what they're doing? But your joke about yourself saying that you stumbled a little bit when you were talking about hypocrisy as the opposite of empathy, you know this, but what will happen over the next few years is as you talk more, as you get interviewed more, as you write more, you just peel the onion. And all of a sudden you have these moments, and it comes with age too, where you're like, you know what? Maybe that was a bit intellectual. And here's the deal. Without empathy, we hurt each other. Like, you'll get somewhere where it's just raw. And that's part of the work that you've set up for yourself through this consultancy. I hope you don't mind that commentary. You didn't ask for it.
I mean, I think you're so right. I've been working in strategy for my entire career for 12 plus years, 12 to 15 years at this point is what they normally put in job descriptions for my level. But having worked full time, both agency side and in-house, I'm having to like deprogram myself and deprogram like my way of speaking and my way of articulating myself. I think I often unintentionally come across like I'm either confused or I'm over intellectualizing something for the sake of over intellectualizing it. And I need to deprogram that.
You're working it out and you'll have to pull apart all the assumptions about work and life, etc., as you build your own thing. And, you know, there's a joke from a very well-known account planner in the UK. I mean, one of the early ones, Jim Carroll, he says the collective noun for a group of planners is a confusion of planners. So most of the time we're a little bit confused. We're bouncing around, you know, whether you've got ADHD or not, you're bouncing around between topic and topic. You're thinking about all the interviews you've done, a novel you read when you were 12. You're like, oh, I've got an idea. Boom. So it's just part of the work. Now, you're currently working on a project called How to Speak Strategist. Tell us about that. Why and what is it?
How to Speak Strategist is essentially born from this idea that strategy is something that's not understood by a lot of people. Like when you say that you're a strategist, when you say that you're a planner, you often have to explain it. There's a lot of different interpretations, even in different agencies, and even as strategists ourselves. Like I've seen job descriptions where it's like, we're looking for an activation strategist. And I'm like, what the hell is an activation strategist? I've been doing strategy for, you know, however long I've been doing it, and I don't even know what this is. And so kind of, you know, came of this idea of like, as strategists, we are supposed to help clarify things. And meanwhile, our entire profession is really confusing. And then to, as very clearly indicated in our conversation so far, and as someone who's a, you know, a verbal processor, I struggle a lot with being clear. I struggle a lot from having, you know, been in corporate environments my entire career and using language that isn't clear and trying to figure out how to communicate better myself and having to communicate now that I'm trying to build clients for my own consultancy, communicate to clients like what it is I actually do, how I can actually help them. And so as I've been trying to figure this out for myself and explore this for myself, I was like, I actually think this would hopefully be helpful for other people. And so that's where I've started to kind of figure into this How to Speak Strategist. And the first round of it, the first edition, was about different types of strategists and like really what the role of a strategist is and the different names we have and different types of strategists you might hear of. And this idea of what I like to refer to as a T-shaped strategist, of at the top of the T, you have like your core skills that every strategist needs, which, you know, are things like, you know, being able to ask the right questions and do the right research, you know, and having that curiosity. It's about being able to storytell, you know, uncover insights, you know, all of those types of things. And then the vertical part of the T is like the specialty. And specialties can be something like a digital strategist, which just means that, you know, you're a strategist and you have all those kind of core skills at the top, but like maybe you are more focused on how to meet audiences' needs on digital channels or like a brand strategist where you're really more focused. You know, brand strategist, I think, is both like a catch-all term for strategy in general. I've seen it kind of used that way, but brand strategists are much more focused on like the holistic brand and the story it's telling and how that actual brand is showing up over time in the real world for people, you know, versus product by product or experience by experience. But the second piece that I'm working on now that I was hoping I would be sharing sooner than I have is like lingo and buzzwords that strategists use and or strategists may encounter out in the corporate world and, you know, what they mean and how they're used. It's all the like over intellectual words that I've probably been using this entire conversation and trying to untrain myself from using. But it's also, you know, words that we overuse and are also very commonly confused, like insight, like tension, like storytell, like narrative, but also just kind of more general kind of like marketing or corporate-y terms. And I'm just trying to figure out how best to kind of structure that and hopefully put that out in the world to help people, A, understand strategists better, but also help us, I think, communicate more clearly, which is a huge part of our job and something I struggle a lot with.
Yeah, it is. The strategy kids will love that. So I look forward to seeing that. I just wanted to end with one, I guess, like a nudge and then get a quick response to this. So when I look at your website, Mildred May, it's informative. But from what I can tell, just looking at the homepage, there's no personal story there. And my nudge to you is consider a world in which over the next few years, you bring your personal story into the center of your work and into the center of the story about the brand and see what kinds of people it attracts and what level of intensity it attracts them at. My hypothesis is that you somehow connect some of the story you told us today to why you do strategy and the way you do it. You will attract clients that you really want to work with, and you'll do really, really fulfilling work. If I was to be a little bit cheeky, if it's okay, as you go, I'd encourage you to think about this, that if you don't do that, I'm being a bully here, that maybe you're half-stepping and you're going to keep yourself in limbo, right? You've committed to yourself by setting this company up. Sure, a crisis started it, but that happens to most of us or to many of us, right? Something bad happens and we go work out what to do, which is great. But I'm going to say to you, there's probably a half-stepping limbo in which you're trying to work out what kind of brand strategist to be when the tools, the techniques, the stories, they're there. Turn them into a rainbow, bring them front and center and see what happens to your life. That would be my little bully nudge, if that's okay. What's your response?
First of all, I couldn't agree more, but I think there's a big factor in there that I want to call out, which is practicality at this moment for me. And I think for a lot of strategists starting out, there's like the one step in, I think it's a completely fair and accurate statement. I think that like I have to balance pragmatism with idealism. And I have this ideal, but right now, like I can't go all in on that from a financial perspective. I have to go broader, you know? Am I doing it again?
I'm going to provoke you. And people listening to this can be like, such a typical middle-aged white man with his opinions and patriot. Yeah, fine. Say it to me. It comes from a place of compassion when I'm a bully. I think the way for you, especially based on how I understand you, is to go all in. Maybe for the first 5 years, most work you get will come from people who already know you or who know somebody who knows you. Therefore, what's the point of the brand? The point of the brand initially starts with getting you together as a person to be like, okay, you know what? I belong in this company. This is what we're going to do. There's a sense of structure. Good. Platform, going to jump off it. I would just challenge you. I'm being a little bit more aggressive than I usually am. Go all in soon and see what happens. I've coached people to do this before and it's helped them. Okay. And that's, yeah, survivorship bias, blah, 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 blah. Most people who will give you work in the first year or two, you know them already, or they know someone who knows you, right? So you don't need to build a brand for them. You are the brand. So that's my little nudge. If people want to find you on the internet, and especially How Strategists Speak when you publish that or when you have published that, where is the best place to look?
Best place to look would be my website, which is mildredmay.com, or my LinkedIn, Elizabeth Bromberg. But I'm also on the internet, Twitter, Instagram as ebroms.
All right. I have a feeling there's going to be a multi-channel campaign promoting this piece of content. And for those who might have missed it, Mildred May, M-A-E, not M-A-Y, M-A-E.com. Elizabeth, go all in. That's what I would say to you. But thank you for sharing your story with us today. I know these kinds of episodes reach people often when they need them in a sense of crisis, or it just helps someone who's struggling to realize that they're not that unusual, which is something that a lot of us want to think. Like, oh, it's just me. You know, I'm depressed. It's just me. The world's falling apart. No. There are lots of people dealing with these sorts of things. And that's not to trivialize the feeling. It's just to say, look, then the cliche comes, you're not alone. And that can give us a little bit of a solace. So thank you for sharing your story with me today. I really look forward to seeing what you do with Mildred May. And I'm not going to apologize again for bullying you unless you want me to.
I will take it. And it's great advice. And I need to figure out what that looks like. So I appreciate you challenging me. It's not bullying, it's challenging.
There you go. That's what I'm here for, especially as I get older. I feel a sense of urgency. I could die soon. Like, okay. Thank you very much for being here on Sweathead today, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Mark.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.